Hi, kids. Welcome to Bronco Land. We got some smart ones in the room.
Thank you for tuning in to the DenverBroncos.com podcast. Ben and Mace with you on a nice sunny Thursday afternoon. And as it just so happens, we're about a week away from the start date, but a week away once this posts on Friday from the actual start of athletic activities in the form of football on Friday.
Yes, but no pads. It's going to be that training camp does start next Friday. And actually for media, it gets underway next Thursday when head coach Gary Kubiak and some players speak with the media at the annual media barbecue that I know the that all of us who've been covering the team for a long time annually look forward to. But the first couple of days are part of kind of easing into things. You're not, per rules that were set in the new CBA, no pads go on, I believe, until at least Sunday, the third day of practice. So it's, the Broncos will ease into it, but certainly for Broncos fans who haven't seen their team on the field and in action since that divisional playoff game that I know all of them want to forget about, I'm sure everyone's going to be excited, especially coming out to Dove Valley, which is newly renovated, the hillside. We actually had a press conference here on Wednesday talking about the hillside and the other enhancements in advance of training camp. So pretty exciting time.
You know, the more I think about it, well, obviously this is going to be my first training camp, and with that, it's going to be my first training camp with fans. I was actually here for a little bit of last year's as it was coming to a close in the final couple of weeks. But I was wondering, maybe we do some podcast involvement on the berm with some fans, get some questions in that way. We used to do that, the live, what was it, Periscope? We used to do the Periscope, mm-hmm. and that got shut down. But, if we take some questions from some fans on the berm, I think that could be interesting. So come prepared.
Yeah, come prepared, and why not? This is... Last year it was pretty rough being without the fans. I mean, the football work got done, but players and even me and media alike, and I think even the coaches missed having 2,000 to 3,000 fans a day sitting on the berm watching practice. It creates a sense of excitement. It jazzes up the atmosphere, and it's that first day or two, it's pretty easy to get excited about practice because hey, it's been it's been months since there were games. I think there's a lot of pent up energy involved, and certainly that first day that pads go on, there's a lot of pent up energy. Last year, practice lost its edge without the fans. I mean, it was easy to have that intensity early when training camp started, but as you get into day 5, 6, 7, the dog days of camp, when you didn't have the fans there, everything just everything seemed off. The players feed on the energy that the fans bring. I mean, I know some fans may not feel like that they make a difference. Trust me, they do. And the players love seeing the fans out here, and it's the involvement. I mean, if you've come to training camp, you're familiar with the tradition that was established in the last few years of fans standing up and stretching along with the players, doing the exercise at the same time. So,
happy birthday.
Yeah, and singing happy birthday or, singing along, a player would sing along with the music and would encourage fans to do so as well. Those are the kind of things that help the players and even the coaches as well kind of break through the monotony of training camp. And, it's a receiver.
It fosters a tie.
Yeah, it does. And you're not going to get closer to the players than you will at training camp. I mean, when you're at the if you go to the stadium for a game, hey, it's great. But there's a pretty good distance separating the stands from the sideline and the stands from the field. But out here, not so much. And then at the end of practice every day, I should say, you get to come down. They'll move the ropes a little bit so you can get closer for autograph time. And as was pointed out on Wednesday, there are going to be two position groups every day signing autographs, not just one. So twice as many chances to get autographs and or even just shake the hand of your favorite Broncos. So it's so much more exciting when you've got the fans involved. This is, you know, a business as big as the NFL. It's easy, you know, to kind of for it to be impersonal at times, but then when you get to training camp and everyone can come in for free and sit on the hillside, pull out a picnic blanket, watch practice, and then get a chance to meet those guys after, you know, it's really exciting. And I can tell you the players, one and all, really do appreciate seeing all the fans out there. And I'm sure that, you know, more than a few players, especially rookies from smaller schools, they're going to walk out on that field next Friday morning, see 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 people, hopefully 5,000, because that's how many the berm can accommodate. And I think they're going to be a little bit awestruck. That's pretty cool.
A little bit of a taste of the accommodations at Mile High from the fans here. I do want to mention real quick, on the website, DenverBroncos.com, we have a tips for training camp. Obviously, that ranges from parking. You know, there are limited amounts of spots, but so get here early. And it ranges to health, because there's not a whole lot of shade.
The trees are gone. That was the one thing that I really liked, the one aspect of Dove Valley that I really liked that was sacrificed as a part of this renovation. If you've come out to training camp before, you probably sat in the shade on the south and west sides of the field, but now those trees are gone. So
sunscreen,
bring it.
There's no umbrellas. I think
right. The umbrellas are not allowed at training camp, and in fact, the NFL bag policy is in place, so you've got to have kind of the clear bag, and it's got to be a specific size and all that. Again, you can consult DenverBroncos.com for all the details of that. If you're going to bring a lens on your camera, the length of the lens can be no longer than the length of a credit card, so please bear that in mind as well. And you can take all the still photos you want, but no video. You can't shoot video during practice, and there will be security people looking up to make sure that, you know,
you don't want to get on Fred video. Fleming's bad side.
No, not Fred. And I'll tell you, some of those other security guys make Fred look like a puppy dog. You know, some of them will really come down on you. So you don't want to run afoul of them. You don't want to ruin your day. You know, just come out, watch practice, you know, take all the still photos you want, you know, have a good time. I recommend carpooling. I mean, as Swanee said, limited amount of parking at the facility. There's, you know, there's going to be a couple of dirt lots to which fans will have access, in addition to some paved spots over in front of the indoor practice facility. But again, the more people, if you can get four people into a car, five people into a car to come out to training camp, that's great, because that probably means that that another three or four more people behind you are going to be able to get in. So, you know, think of everybody else. Don't just think of yourself when coming out to camp.
Now, on the website, we're also winding down our training camp previews. We've had videos from our own Chris and Phil, who are and you are on those previews.
And Rod Mackey of 9 News, and also Andy Lindahl from KOA have joined us as well.
There you go. And you have been doing position-by-position breakdowns. And coming soon will be not just a single position, but just a group in general, the rookies.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this is going to be the awakening before the season really gets underway. Mini camp and OTAs are a nice way to ease into it, but I think that might be a point where some rookies are really going to get a taste with the pads on.
Yeah, and they actually, not with pads, but they get a few extra days out here before the start of training camp. They can report on Monday for some extra work. It's, you know, you're allowed to do that. You're allowed to have rookies in a few days early, and I think that's going to allow a lot of them to get a jump start. I mean, a great example, Trevor Siemian, Broncos 7th-round pick, quarterback out of Northwestern. He's coming off of the torn ACL that he had last November, and by getting in here, he's going to get some extra reps, because once you get to training camp, you know, Peyton Manning's got to get his reps. Brock Osweiler, whose development has been a focal point of this offseason, he's going to get his reps. Zach Dysart, I think everyone's maybe forgotten a bit about him, but he's still in the mix. 7th-round pick from back in 2013. He's going to get some reps. That's going to make it tough for Trevor Siemian, I think, to get out on the field at times. So guys like him, they're going to get that extra work before training camp. It's kind of a last chance to make an impression before you start training camp. Of course, they had plenty of opportunities during OTAs and minicamp. Semien, not so much because he still wasn't all the way back from the torn ACL, but he did throw in 7-on-7 work. So, you know, he's just one of the guys that's gonna benefit, but I think the first few days of next week it may help him more than anybody else.
I think I remember him saying he was looking to be full go at
right
time training camp started.
Full go, but the problem is those other three guys getting snaps.
Yeah.
And certainly we're going to see Peyton Manning get a few days off here and there, and that's gonna, you know, and there'll be a chain reaction that follows that everyone will move up a line. But the guy that they clearly want to get the most reps to, you know, beyond Peyton Manning, of course, is Brock Osweiler. So it's going to be tough for Zach Dysart and Trevor Siemian. They're going to have to make the most of reps that may be a little more limited than for the top two quarterbacks.
While I was on the topic of injuries, among the players who were doing mostly rehab during OTAs, pretty much all of them said they were aiming to be back at the start of training camp. That includes Brandon Marshall, mm-hmm. Danny Trevathan, and Shane Ray. I think that might wrap it up. But I think all those guys said they're looking to be back, so that'll be something to watch as well.
Well, certainly Ray, by the end of OTAs, was seeing some work in 7-on-7.
Mm-hmm.
So I expect he's going to be ready and full go. He certainly indicated that in talking the last few weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, Brandon Marshall and Danny Trevathan, I think those are going to be the two that bear the closest monitoring. Where are they when training camp starts? I mean, they've both been running. You know, they've been here at the facility working out on a daily basis, but you don't want to rush them back. You don't want to throw them out there a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks before they're actually ready and potentially sacrifice them in the regular season. I think the Broncos are going to be very patient with them. If they're not 100%, you're not going to see them out there full tilt. I think certainly, you know, the Broncos would like to see them, you know, at least doing, say, individual work when training camp begins and then easing them into 7-on-7 and teamwork. You know, but the thing is with them, you know what you have. Even though the Broncos are going from a 4-3 to a 3-4, they're the proven commodities. It's a simpler defense, simpler scheme. You figure they're going to be able to adjust and do fine. The ancillary benefit of them taking their time to come back is you're getting more snaps for Todd Davis, more work with the first team for Steven Johnson, and then the chain reaction from there, you're going to get long looks for Corey Nelson, Lamine Barrow, and also Reggie Walker, among others, among the inside linebackers.
And then worst case scenario, those guys, maybe they do right. extensive work in special teams instead.
Well, that's how
there's so much value in having that experience.
And that's how those guys are going to make the team. The back end of the depth chart, especially at linebacker, at a lot of positions, but linebacker more so than others, and Gary Kubiak and Joe DeCamillis have indicated this, that the linebacker core is going to be pretty big. I think we could see as many as 10 linebackers on the 53-man roster. Obviously, Broncos are in a 3-4, so you're going to start 4, but the reason why they're going to emphasize linebackers on the final roster is simply because of special teams. Linebackers have a lot of versatility, can be, you know, you can use them in a lot of different areas. You know, they're kind of the best balance almost of speed and size at a lot of roles on special teams. And, you know, that's why, you know, what Lamine Barrow and Todd Davis and Corey Nelson and Reggie Walker, what they do on special teams is going to be at least as important as what they do on defense. But that being said, with Trevathan and Marshall coming off injuries, with the Broncos wanting to take it easy with them, not wanting to rush them back, and frankly, with the nature of Marshall and Trevathan's injuries, of course, Trevathan had 3 injuries to the same area, to around his knee, and Marshall is coming off of a mid-foot injury that he had last year, and then he had surgery on it in April. You know, you want to make sure you're very well covered. You've got to have backups in whom you have faith. Steven Johnson, I know they have faith in him as a two-down guy against the run. Todd Davis, I think, is kind of the wild card. He started late last year. Coaches have raved about his progress so far through the offseason. Every snap that he's gotten on the first team has helped him. And if he continues on that trajectory, continues to play well, then the Broncos definitely will not have to rush Trevathan and Marshall back, because they'll have faith in Todd Davis. But again, I mentioned Nelson, I mentioned Barrow, and of course Reggie Walker, special teams demon in San Diego. You figure he's going to factor in somewhere.
As far as offensive line is going to receive so much attention,
mm-hmm.
and it already has already. And there's some inexperience on the left side, especially. You look at Gino, and you look at Lou, and you look at Chris Clark on the right side. Those are guys who have started before. Left side, Ben Garland, Tyson Brilo are guys. You have a rookie and one who's, I think, in his second year of playing experience. So while they have gotten the OTAs and mini camp under their belt, what do you expect to see from them in training camp, at least for the first week or two?
Well, it all comes down to what happens when the pads go on. We've seen Sembrilo and Garland improve during OTAs and minicamp. You know, by working next to each other every down, they're getting that cohesion you need in a zone blocking scheme, because so much of what happens in that type of blocking scheme, it's not man on man. It's what you do in concert. You've got to have chemistry to make this thing work. And that was one reason, I think, why Gary Kubiak and Rick Dennison did not hesitate to put Sembrilo at left tackle next to Ben Garland, because they understood that the more repetitions they got, even without pads in May and June, the better it was going to be for them long term. You know, it was tough losing Ryan Clady, but if you were going to adapt, you're better off and make that change. You're better off doing it right then and there, rather than, you know, being a bit indecisive and trying out different guys. Instead, you allowed those two to work together. So, assuming that they can translate their process, their progress in the process, when pads go on, that's the Broncos' best shot. Okay, yeah, it's not ideal. You were hoping to have a perennial Pro Bowler like Ryan Clady at left tackle. That was the plan. Now you're on a contingency plan. So let's not try to make this like it was some sort of grand plan. It wasn't. This is the backup plan that the Broncos are using right now. And because it's the backup plan, you cannot expect it to have the same results right out of the gate as what your initial plan was. But you're gambling that over time, Tyson Brilo, who you picked in the second round for a reason, can adapt and grow. And you're also gambling that Ben Garland, who has the physical and mental skill set to play in this offense, that he can get better with the playing time that he hasn't had. That being said, there are going to be some bumps. I'm really curious to see what happens to them when the pads go on, you know, when all of a sudden you're engaging with Malik Jackson, Derek Wolfe, DeMarcus Ware, Shane Ray, Vaughn Miller, when you're engaging with those guys mm-hmm. full contact and seeing how it goes. You know, DeMarcus Ware said he saw progress in Sembrilo during minicamp and OTAs, but hey, you know, that's well and good. Let's see what happens when the pads go on. And then the other reason why you put Sembrilo out there at left tackle right away, you have Chris Clark over there at right tackle, and you know that he can provide, you know, competent, good, solid play at left tackle because of what he did through most of 2013. I think a lot of fans fixate on his struggles in Super Bowl 48, but he actually had a pretty decent season working at left tackle until that point. And I think, you know, go back to the game in November 2013 against Kansas City when Chris Clark absolutely shut down Justin Houston, which the way Houston was playing at that point in the season didn't really seem possible. That was a matchup that I know made a lot of Broncos fans nervous at the time, and Clark dominated Justin Houston. So there's your insurance policy in case if Sembrilo doesn't develop, you can move Houston over, you know, or you can move Clark over there. And then if Ben Garland struggles, your insurance policy is a guy like Shelly Smith, who the Broncos brought in the offseason. He has experience in this scheme. But the fact that Sembrilo and Garland are out there, it's clear that, you know, that's what, now that Clady's gone, That's the guy. Those are the guys that you want on the left flank, and they, and frankly, they have the highest ceilings. That's what you're
right.
You're accepting that. Okay, they're going to make some mistakes. There's going to be some.
You're playing
time.
The long term game.
Yeah,
with them.
You're saying, okay, who's going to be better after say 4 or 5 weeks of play in the regular season? You're saying that these guys are going to improve with time. That whereas. You know, with Chris Clark and Shelly Smith, those are veteran guys, and you know more what they are. You have an idea what their potential is, but you don't know what the ceiling of Cimbrello and Garland is. So why not put them out there, accept that you're going to have mistakes, and hope that with time they improve. You know, that's actually the strategy that Baltimore applies, and you know, and certainly Gary Kubiak and Rick Dennison were exposed to that last year working for the Ravens, playing, you know, like you say, the long game, playing the long game rather than the short game.
One of the rookie adjustments I am really excited to see for, well, no reason other than he's kind of like a, what's the baseball movie with the guy who gets the bat? He carves the bat out of the tree.
The Natural.
The Natural. That's the punter, Carl Schmitz. That's what I kind of see it as.
So was his right leg struck by lightning?
Maybe.
Do we have?
No, here, not if, a lot is known about this yeah. guy.
If he makes the Broncos 53-man roster, I'm going to propose that he get a tattoo that says Wonderleg with a lightning bolt, like Wonder Boy from The Natural.
Well, he's. I'm just hoping that at one point he kicks the ball such a booming kick, mm-hmm. it rises and eventually it skies into one of the lights, and then you know it explodes like the ball.
Where do you spot the ball then?
I don't know. I think after that point they just end the game.
Do they? I mean, is that a touchback? Because you know, if it's like Tropicana Field in Major League Baseball down in St. Mm-hmm. Petersburg, Florida, they have ground rules for the catwalks
that are in the roof.
Yeah, if you hit, there's certain catwalks, and they actually have foul poles on the catwalks there. So if you hit it if you hit it wide of the foul pole on the catwalk, it's foul. But if you hit it in fair territory in the catwalk, on some of them it's a double, on some of them it's a home run, depending on which one.
It seems like poor planning.
Yeah, well, having spent some years in the Tampa Bay area, I can tell you it was cheap planning. The roof was tilted toward the south and the west. So okay. Obviously that's the sun shines from that direction a good chunk of the day, but the bigger reason was, pardon me, it does allow for more natural light. That was part of it, but by slanting the roof, and it's a baseball stadium, so you figure you need more seats behind home plate than you do in the outfield.
Sure.
So by slanting the roof, you were saving on air conditioning as well. Because, hey, the roof doesn't need to go as high beyond the outfield seats, right? Because you only have, I think it's like 26 rows of seats out there. So, hey, just have the roof slant. Have the roof slant and have it in a direction that more light comes through the translucent panels.
A good idea in theory, but
then they actually played in it.
Yeah.
I mean, so, but yeah. So
That's like when you're playing as a kid
and
you're in like... You're like in the front of a house or side of a house, right? Well, if it hits the roof, if it hits the front part of the roof, that's a double. Mm-hmm. If you hit over the house, well, that's a home run, obviously. Yeah.
The way to do it is just simple. If you've got a big wall, you say it's in play, like the Green Monster,
right?
You know, turning lazy fly balls to left field into home runs for the last 103 years, but. Yeah, to go back to Carl Schmitz, if he did hit the lights, and actually in Dallas this comes up. Remember, AJ Trapasso was trying to hit the Jerrytron that hangs over the field there at AT&T Stadium. Wow, I don't know. That's a good question. Schmitz is capable of it, I think. I mean, he's got one of the strongest legs I've ever seen.
Yeah,
and. A very free and easy delivery as well. That's the thing. I mean, I recall when Matt Prater first came here, he had a very natural delivery, and then over time he got old. You know, he got older, and he could still get a lot of distance on the football, but it was clear on his kicks, but it was clear that he had to put a lot more body English, as it were, into his kicks. Whereas Schmitz, it's just a very easy wind up. The issue for him, I think, is going to be placement and working under pressure. What kind of punter and kickoff specialist is he going to be on August 14th at CenturyLink Field with 66,000 people wearing number 12 jerseys, dog cussing him? And that's what I want to know. What is, when the lights go on, what is he going to do? A, that's point A. And then point B, how is his precision punting?
Yeah.
You know, Joe DeCamillis tells him, I need you to drop this thing inside the 10-yard line. Can he do that on a consistent basis? I think the answers to those two questions are going to determine whether he can beat out Britton Colquitt for a spot or not. Certainly the fact that he can do kickoffs as well helps, because DeCamillis and Gary Kubiak want to keep two guys for kicker, punter, and kickoff specialists. Late last year, they had three. Brandon McManus can place kick and kickoff. Carl Schmitz can punt and kickoff. Connor Barth, really only in the picture on place kicks. Britton Colquitt, really only in the picture on punts.
Mm-hmm.
Neither one of them worked on kickoffs during OTAs. It's going to be a fact. It's an interesting competition, because even it's not simply the guys competing for the place kicker job and the guys competing for the punter job, because kickoffs are involved. It's all one collection. It's a competition, I think, unlike anything we've seen in recent Broncos history.
One of the things we talk about pressure, I think back to the muff punt I think Britton had, and it eventually became, I think, a punt return for a touchdown, sadly. But the snap was off or something, but he picked it up and he had a really
in New
good
England,
punt.
Yes, he had a great punt, but
Julian Edelman, I think.
Yes, and it messed up the timing.
Yeah.
On the coverage, and you had guys that were slightly out of position. You know, I think, you know, Corey Nelson, I recall, you know, looked like he had a chance, but he was out of position, and then Edelman took off. You know, hey.
But those are those high pressure situations. Mm-hmm. We kind of have to ask, okay, but...
And credit to Britton Colquitt for, he muffed the punt, but then he got the punt off.
It was really clean. It was a good punt.
He did his job in recovering. Can Carl Schmitz, if he muffs a snap, or if there's a bad snap? Now, that's something very rare with Aaron Brewer, who's one of the best at what he does. But, hey, sometimes bad snaps happen. How do you react to that? And the other thing to consider as well, in all likelihood, the punter... going to be the holder on place kicks. And both Colquitt and Schmitz have worked with both kickers so far on place kicks during offseason work.
I do want to talk to Schmitz about the science of punting. I had a chance last year to talk to Jeff Rogers, I think, was the special teams coordinator then. And we talked for like 10 minutes just about punting and all the kind of strategic things that are involved in that, and the types of punting, like, you know, different punters use, like the Jeff Fiegels, who was kind of like an old school guy who could pretty much place a punt wherever he wanted.
You remember Jason Baker? He used to punt in Carolina, but also punted here in Denver.
Yeah.
He was the one who really brought the rugby style punt into popularity in the NFL, where instead of holding the ball straight out and kind of, you know, spiraling a bit when you drop it to punt, would basically hold it on an angle with one end of the ball point toward the ground. And what that did was it would get a little bit more backspin. It didn't get a lot of distance, but it was easier to place, and it was unreturnable, and it was called a rugby style punt, because sometimes guys in rugby, when they're punting the ball, they'll use a very similar tactic as well.
See, that's fascinating.
Yeah,
I mean, punters don't receive a whole lot of attention,
and you know, Colquitt's been here, and going back to he was on the practice squad late in 2009. I mean, he's had some pretty good numbers over the years in terms of placement, in terms of avoiding touchbacks. I know he wants to get better on his distance numbers, as well. They've been a bit off. His gross and net have been a bit off the last couple of years, but he's always been pretty good in terms of placement, and that's he would be good to talk to about that as well. You know how, and especially Colquitt's had an interesting trajectory because in 2011 the Broncos had the number one rushing offense, but they had a dreadful pass offense. As I think most Broncos fans recall, for most of the season it was ranked near the bottom of the league, and for the month of November was just a complete non-entity except for the occasional deep ball. So that offense had a lot of three and outs, and Colquitt a lot of times, because if you're going three and out, that means the line of scrimmage is at the 20, 25, 27, 30-yard line. And then and then unless you got an elite punt returner, you know, back there, you're just worried about blasting it. And just send that thing as high and as far as you can. Peyton Manning comes in, the offense obviously becomes much more effective in 2012 and onward. And so that means a lot more of your punts are coming from midfield. Because you know, you have fewer three and outs, and then thus your emphasis changes from simply blasting the ball to more often, okay, I'm trying to drop that ball inside the 10-yard line. And then the other thing that came up for in 2013 for Colquitt when the offense was breaking records was, you know, some games he wouldn't be used at all. I think actually Vic Lombardi of Channel 4 may have done something about his lack of on air about the lack of use, kind of, you know, tongue-in-cheek piece on the forgotten Bronco, which that year was Britton Colquitt, because some, you know, if the offense was rolling down the up and down the field and scoring every time, the punter's just kind of sitting there. Well, all he was doing was holding on place kicks. So, you know, Colquitt's had an interesting career in terms of how his job description has evolved a little bit based on what the offense has done. So, I would say when you do that story, talk to him as well, because I think Britton's very, very insightful as well.
Yeah,
to go back to the competition, it's a big summer for him.
Yep,
he's got a big contract. He's got to justify that big contract. I think that's a competition that it's special teams. Colquitt's proven and maybe under the radar, but I think it's something that's going to bear watching in the summer.
Do you? While we're on the topic of specialists, do you remember? I think there was some kind of viral video or something done by a long snapper. I thought it was on Letterman, but I guess I was wrong because I can't find that. But like a long snapper was just doing all these tricks, snapping a ball 20 yards through like a small hoop or something like that.
I found like four of them. I Googled trick shot long snapper. There's this one, he goes by American Snapper on Twitter, Larry the Trick Shot Long Snapper. It opens with him hitting somebody in the head in a locker room. He's got somebody sitting on a yoga ball and he hits him in the head, knocks him off.
Oh, I gotta see this.
Oh gosh. And now there's one where he just snaps it into a portalette. Someone sitting on the portalette. Let's see. Okay, now he's snapping off the roof of his house into a truck. Someone caught it in a truck. You can't see that. I'm sorry. Okay.
No, I'm watching it now.
Yeah. Larry the Trick Shot Long Snapper. You know,
I guess he played for Pitt or something. Yeah. He's here at Pitt's facility. He's wow. He just long snapped it from my high up in Pitt's indoor facility right into a trash can about 40 yards away.
Impressive.
I'm not sure what this one. He's just long snapping balls into a pole.
Larry Fedorov.
I believe is his name. The lost art of long snapping. I guess it's not lost, but the art of long snapping.
Larry Fedorov, according to his LinkedIn bio, he is now a spine sales representative at Stryker in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Too bad. I would have loved to have seen him, get a shot in the league. Of course, Aaron Brewer is as good as they come. You know, Joe Don Duncan can also a long snap as well.
I think I had a... I don't know where I saw this. I could have sworn it was like on Letterman, one of those late night shows. They had an NFL long snapper snap a ball into the like a drive through thing.
Yeah,
and obviously that creates a little bit more havoc than doing this at your house or off the top of your house. Maybe
I'm picturing there's got to be a way to come if we're talking about YouTube legends. There's got to be a way to get Larry the Trick Shot long snapper together with a. The famous Kickalicious.
Well, do you I don't know if you're aware of this, but our stats guy Mitch Tanney, he does the statistics analytics. That's the word I'm looking for. He does analytics for the team, and his brother is Alex Tanney, trick shot quarterback. He's on YouTube as well. This one video of him has 4 million views, so pretty popular, I guess. This is just what college men do in their spare time. Just, you know, there's, like, the guys who do, like, the basketball hoop. And Mitch Tanney's brother throws footballs out of windows to his friends in moving trucks. That's the go-to right there, moving trucks.
Everyone has to have a hobby, and hey... Although I recall seeing someone try to dunk a basket, use a trampoline to dunk a basketball in their backyard, and they end up like catching their leg on the rim, and
that never goes well.
No,
I've seen too many videos of people on Twitter or wherever trying to do basketball dunks or basketball trick dunks off their roof.
Yes,
and those never go well. Never.
Yeah, I just found the YouTube of the guy who gets his leg caught in the rim. He's in his backyard. He gets hurt. He's dangling from the rim. Like, one friend tries to help. The other then tries to help. And then the guy falls down. This poor kid's writhing in agony. And they just pick up the basketball and they just stand there.
There was, this was maybe 5 years ago. In the NBA at the All-Star weekend or whatever, one of, I think it was the Milwaukee Bucks mascot, was standing on the rim, like, by the backboard part where it meets the backboard. And at the same time, while he was kind of like, hey, you know, let's pump up the crowd, let's go, the Charlotte Bobcats mascot, Rufus, was at half court, back to the rim, doing a, overhead half-court shot attempt. He made it, but that's because it hit the mascot, Bango the Buck.
I think it's Bango.
Bango. Yeah.
It's not Bucky, because Bucky is Wisconsin's Badger. Yeah, here it is. It's at the all. Yeah, I found it.
You found the video? And... poor Bango ended up tearing his ACL.
Oh wait, no, I didn't see that. The one I'm seeing is Rufus hitting it. The mascot climbs on the front of the in front of the backboard and gets hit in the groin.
Which one?
Oh wait, there it is. I didn't. Okay, first he gets hit in the groin,
and then he falls or something.
Like right there, like. Boom.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah.
Man getting hit by football.
Basketball. And then he tries to go down
He
through.
Tries to get down. He slips and. He goes all the way through the rim. Like he falls down. Like his entire body goes through the hoop.
Yeah. And then he kind of rolls around on the ground. Kind of clearly in pain, but he gets up, and true to the argument that's been going around the Denver Broncos digital media offices this week, which is, can you go on if with a torn ACL and play like professional sports for, you know, maybe not the rest of your career, but finish out a season or something like that?
You can, depending on the position.
Right, but you're not going to be playing well.
Well, I mean, it depends. I mean, it's you've got to be careful, but
But you can't like tear up your ACL any further, I guess.
Well, I mean, once it's torn, it's torn.
Right. But you can still do other structural damage to it.
I mean, John Elway played his career without an ACL.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Tore his ACL in high school.
Whew. Huh. That's wild.
Yeah, he missed the rest of the season, but he played baseball the following year. He played his career without an ACL.
That's stunning.
That's one more reason why John Elway is John Elway. He played his career without an ACL. But I mean, I've seen guys like Stan. I mean, you know, and guys walk off the field. You know, Von Miller walked off the field when he tore his ACL.
So Chris Harris.
Chris Harris did.
Phil Milani is doing the underdog video about Chris Harris, mm-hmm. and when came time to find video, they don't have video of it because it was just a play.
It was just a play. I mean, I've referenced it. I zeroed in on the play where he left, and I went back and I watched the game film, and I think he got hurt there, but I couldn't tell for certain.
Yeah.
It was so innocuous.
DeJuan Blair, NBA player, has ACLs on either.
Wow.
Either knee.
Was he born with that?
He had two high school surgeries.
Wow.
I don't know. Well, I mean, he's no superstar now, but I mean, if you're playing in the NBA without ACLs, you got to be
that
doing
that seems impossible.
Something. Well, he never was the most athletic player. He was kind of one of those.
Yeah, but you still
got to
jump at least
guys.
A little bit. It's not like you're staying flat-footed for the most part. But
right.
By the way, to hijack it for a moment, when we're talking about trampolines and all that, I queued up. Remember Slam Ball? I queued up
some slam ball
highlights.
Do I remember Slam Ball? Sir, you are talking to a man who wrote a feature story on Slam Ball.
So I'm in the company of the Slam Ball savant.
More or less. I follow them on Facebook. They have
actually, Slam Ball
time.
Was so long ago. Was it Facebook or was it MySpace?
Well, they have tried to like okay, so let me tell you about Slam Ball, the history. This is going to be a new podcast. So Slam Ball started decades ago now.
I recall it airing on I think it was on like TNN
Spike
before it became like TNN, then it became Spike.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't it air like after arena football games? I mean, just
something.
It was
like
the
that.
You know. Or when the XFL, TNN was kind of the weird sports channel there for a moment.
So the genesis of it was this guy and his friend, I can't remember their names right now, this guy and his friend, just drew up this sport on a bar napkin, as is the way that pretty much every good idea is invented.
Well, I mean, the slam ball sounds like a dare.
Well, right. Yeah. It practically is. It's like, what if we just put trampolines instead of wood? Yeah. I still don't understand how people don't get seriously like maimed, but people do it. So anyway, so they kind of pitched this idea to TV networks, and the TV networks kind of want it to be more of just like kind of scripted, and they want it to be a sport. They want it to be like the next big thing.
But they
So they go out.
But the TV networks sound like they want pro wrestling if they want scripted.
Oh, exactly. That's what they want, which I think is kind of a good idea. But anyway, so. But they have to find players. So basically they find, you know, people who don't make it to the NFL, people don't make it to hockey.
Right, because you could hit your opponent at midcourt, right?
Mm-hmm. You could hit your player. And basically they were looking for players who were very gifted athletically. You know, maybe they didn't have the skills to make it as, you know, they didn't have a jump shot. They didn't have... I don't know, great route running or whatever. Anyway, they find all these kind of misfits, and they make up teams. And I think they have had a couple like 2-year contracts or something. And then all of a sudden, it kind of just went away. I mean, when you really think about the era we are in now with YouTube and all these video like vines and video sharing on demand, Swam ball is the perfect sport for that.
You have to monetize. That's the only thing.
And so I talked to one of the co-founders. This is a couple years ago. And at that time, they were working to expand it, but not at home. They were actually running a lot of camps in China. They had gotten players like Kenny Anderson was one of the players, some guys like that.
There was an international tournament in China in 2012, according to the Wikipedia page.
Yep. And they were trying to expand it that way. They were trying to, I think they were setting up swam ball.
Everyone's trying to get into China. Arena Football's trying to start a league in China.
There's a lot of people there.
The NFL wanted to play a preseason game in China, but that didn't come to pass. But during a Broncos-Patriots Sunday night game in 2006, the promotion of the China Bowl was such that they actually painted the China Bowl logo on the Gillette Stadium field for that game. Because the next summer, the Patriots and Seahawks were going to play in the China Bowl. It was going to be at the Bird. It was actually going to be, I believe, the first event at the Bird's Nest, the Olympic Stadium in Beijing that was used in the 08 games. But nothing ever came of it, and there hasn't been a whisper about the NFL in China since. Everyone wants to get to China.
And swam ball.
Anyway,
I'm looking at the story I actually wrote. It's on SB Nation. You can just search SB Nation swam ball. At the time of recording this podcast, none of this has really come to pass. But he said that they were in talks for a 30 for 30 with ESPN. I don't believe that's happened, unless that's kind of.
Like your headline: the story of swam ball, a sport where we're all superheroes.
I'm rereading it, and I don't want to toot my own horn, but I like reading it. they were, trying to reach out to the grassroots. Obviously, this is like a retro kind of coming up thing at the time, especially. People were, looking back and like, swam ball was awesome and all this. Mm-hmm. So I think people were interested in, at least where I was at the time in Chapel Hill, there was a trampoline center, go figure. And they had like basketball hoops in there, so you could ideally play swam ball in there.
Well, let's see. My 3-year-old has a trampoline. She has a little basketball set. I'm smelling something here. and then I'm smelling a trip to the emergency.
Yeah, room. I was about to say maybe.
So let's not do that. I think we'll just stick to the plastic baseball and bat in the backyard and the soccer ball.
Can't fail. Swam ball is a good backup, though.
Yeah, very very lucrative way of entering athletics, I imagine.
I'm looking at this story, and I was in college at the time, and I just basically interviewed people I knew on Twitter who were interested in talking about swam ball. So those are my other sources. I think I also submitted this as a paper to my feature stories class. So
yeah.
So that was some of my my sources. You had to have three sources, and well.
Oh, I remember that. I remember
couldn't
that.
Find any people on the streets who were interested in swam ball.
But it's three sources, but at least it's not like some newspaper companies where they say it's three sources and one of them has to be like a specific like. Race, either a minority or someone who's in the minority in that particular field, you know.
Well, my only restriction was they needed to be interested in swam ball, so it was pretty easy.
I think. Yeah.
Anyway. Well, with that, I'll leave y'all to go search out that article.
We'll talk. Yeah. Well, next week we're going to have actual football. Well, actually, this time next week we will not have started camp, but.
But maybe
by the time we do this, players will be here, and you know
exactly.
Cross our fingers, we'll get a player to join us.
Oh, that would be nice. We had Ben Garland a few weeks ago.
The rookies are going
to
be in
nice
next
to have
week.
Yeah. One of the rookies with us.
Yes.
Well, stay tuned for that, and thanks for listening.